Party time, motherfuckers.
Yes. And we're on. Okay, so first off, we were sitting here listening to Annabelle tell a story about being on campus and having some sort of confrontation with a basic bitch and some sorority girls on the bus.
Basically, and we found out that Annabelle a bad bitch, and yes, she ain't afraid to say shit.
The story lasted about 7 minutes, but the best part was about a minute into it, maybe 2 minutes into it, Dylan started playing Jennifer Lopez music on his phone.
Computer, and it was right next to her.
And then I realized that he was doing it, and Annabelle never realized what was going on. She just adjusted the volume of her voice so that we could hear her story over the music. So then I pulled my phone out and opened up Spotify and did the same thing. We had two different J-Lo songs going on in the room
at
the
same time. And mine was going on for 4 minutes.
Yes, and mine was on for at least two, and she did not realize until she stopped talking. And she was just there, and she, all of a sudden she goes, wait, is this J-Lo?
I hate you guys.
Yes. It's just the worst.
I see, I don't like her, and so I don't know her music, because I will not support her. No views from me.
You refuse to even acknowledge that her voice exists.
Is there a Jen? We need to find out if there's a Jennifer Lopez fan club, and we need to sign her up.
Or oh my god, get email and the address so they can send you fan mail.
Fan mail.
You wouldn't dare.
I would even be willing. I would be willing even to contribute some sort of money to, if they sent you like a t-shirt or like a gift club.
No, get the Whataburger Christmas sweater.
Yeah, that's the other thing we need to talk about. Win my love
with Whataburger sweaters.
There is a $43 Whataburger Ugly Christmas sweater on sale right now.
And it's worth every penny.
Every fucking penny. Like, yeah. Like, I have gifts that I need to get to for my children, but they're going to have to wait until after I get my Whataburger sweater.
Yeah. Screw your kids. We need Whataburger sweaters so we can be Water Buddies.
That's Oh, Water Buddies.
Water Buddies and Polar Pals. We That's what I've been pals. Saying.
Oh, we're such idiots.
God, we're so great. This is why we have a podcast, this because everything we do is just comedy gold.
Is that what? No, it's not.
Okay, well, everything I say is.
Oh, comedy gold. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Too Scared to Sleep.
You know what episode this is, don't you?
Which episode is this?
This is episode 10.
Episode 10. We finally made it to episode 10.
The big 1-0.
We were so full of vim and vigor when we started talking about how we were going to do it once a week. And we've been together for like 16 weeks and we only have 10 episodes, but it's okay.
You know, life happens and Annabelle has ruined our schedule. It's mostly but that's Annabelle's okay. Problem.
But it's all right.
Because we sit in her house and she listens to us talk.
Yeah, and we want her to contribute, but right now she's scratching scratch-off tickets.
I had a dream.
She had a dream that she was going to win the lottery.
Go win.
Did you? I didn't hear anything about this.
Yeah, I've been having dreams. I've been addicted to playing those apps that, like, you scratch scratch-offs on your phone and, like, all those trivia games where you can win money. I don't know, I got lottery fever, and so I just need to quench my thirst.
Oh my god.
With these tickets. I already won $5.
Ooh.
That she had to give to me because I went and bought beer tonight, and I needed to be reimbursed.
Oh my god. So, basically,
we're at zero sum.
I know. The $5 you made, you don't even get, so you're just throwing money out the window at this point. Okay, cool.
That's the American
way. As long as we're on the same page.
That's the American way. Leave her alone.
That's the American dream.
It's funny that you're doing lottery tickets because you have a dream. My wife got into cross stitch. That's the one with the little...
I swear to God, I thought you were going to say cross-dressing.
Cross-dressing, cross-stitch, cross-fit, all annoying things that people talk about. Too much.
I've got less of a problem with hearing about people cross-dressing.
There's a whole joke about that. It's like an atheist, a vegan, and a CrossFitter all walk into a bar. Which one talks about their thing first? It's usually... Anyway, it's a toss-up. But anyway, she got into cross-stitch. And then she got into cross-stitch on the laptop or a tablet.
What the fuck is that?
I know, where you're doing virtual cross-stitch, which sounds so fucking stupid. I hope she doesn't... She never listens anyway, so... She'll never hear this.
It's true. Your family doesn't support us.
No, she does not. They don't support us emotionally or any other way, financially or anything like that. So it's fine.
Yeah.
I can talk shit if I need to.
I mean, at least my family supports me by giving me the Amazon Prime login.
That's right.
I say give a shout out to Arlene. She listens to our podcast.
Does Arlene listen? Arlene? Arlene M.? Are you listening right now?
Hi, Arlene.
Yes,
Arlene. Hello, Arlene.
Arlene is one of our squads who, Arlene is a squad member who talks to, we see on a pretty regular basis, and I guess she listens. Something else I was going to mention that I've never mentioned before is that my mother-in-law died back in May after going through a battle with cancer.
That's not true. And you mention that all the time.
Not on the podcast.
Oh.
You piece of shit.
I'm sorry. You didn't like her.
The reason that I mention it is because she comes and visits me all the time. She comes and visits me all the time, and I'll tell you why. Her favorite song was Crazy by Gnarls Barkley.
That's a good song.
It is a good song. That song plays on my Spotify randomly all the time when I'm driving. Nice. Her truck. Basically, I inherited her truck after she died. And so I drive this thing to and from work, and I hear that song all the time. And then I was on a camping trip with my son, and somebody turned on their Spotify with a Bluetooth speaker, and another one of her late 80s country songs that she just loved just started blasting over the speakers. And I was like, wow, Granny's here. She's hanging out with us at the camping trip. And then it happened again just yesterday. I went to my son's school for his Thanksgiving lunch, and I took my mother, his grandmother, the other grandma, you know, it's my mom.
Yeah.
Not my wife's mom, who is dead. But she saw my son, and she gave him a hug. My mother said to him, man, you are one handsome dude. And my wife's mother used to call him that all the time. And my mom, there's no way that she would have known that. And she just randomly said it out of nowhere. And I looked at my wife and I was like, your mom is fucking here right now. Like, it's just one of those things. And I know I'm not the only one to have those sorts of situations happen to them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people talk about it all the time, that there's like these signs that people who have already died are coming to visit, or they're making contact, or letting you know that they're there watching over. My wife does get pretty upset that it only seems to happen to me. I think maybe my mother-in-law is trying to make me go crazy, but it's not working.
I was going to say, maybe your mother-in-law just liked you more than she liked her own daughter.
Maybe so. Or maybe she's just trying to tell me to go to hell.
It could be either one. It's a toss-up. So just go with whatever makes your heart happy.
Makes my heart happy.
Yeah, you know.
Okay. Anything going on with you, Dylan?
Actually, there is something I want to discuss.
Oh, shit.
No, you already know. You know what's coming. You were there. We watched Overlord.
We did watch Overlord.
That was a pile of shit movie.
Yes. I have very strong negative feelings about it, too.
But it's been getting so many good reviews.
From who?
From, like, all these reviewers that I follow. The League of
Blind Moviegoers?
Apparently. And it's like...
The Coalition for Movies with Gigantic Plot Holes?
Oh, I know. The characters were all so cliche. The story was boring as shit for this violent action war science zombie movie. Yes. It was boring as hell.
Absolutely.
It took like half the movie for anything exciting to happen other than like that intro sequence of the planes getting shot.
There were
I don't give a shit about this.
Steven Spielberg did that like 20 years ago in Band of Brothers.
Literally everyone who's made a war movie has done that.
Christopher Nolan did it better.
Yeah. Pretty much anybody who's done it has done it better than that.
Yeah.
It was not a good movie. Plot holes, dumb dialogue, dumb story.
Cardboard cutout characters.
Exactly. All the characters were just... It was so predictable, too.
Oh, yeah.
And they started, like, so many things that they never finished. Like, spoiler alert if you guys haven't seen it, but, like...
If you haven't seen it, don't go and waste your money to see it. Honestly,
don't waste your time.
I mean, maybe if you can sneak into the movie theater and see it for free.
Or when it eventually comes on Netflix or whatever, because nobody else is going to want it.
Oh, absolutely.
But, okay, you remember the ant that they talked about?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so apparently this lady's aunt got abducted by the Nazis and experimented on, and for whatever reason, this aunt was allowed to come back home, but she was super sick, and you catch, like, a glimpse of her eye, and you see, like, black skin or, you know, scales
sores and shit.
Yeah. They show that, and then no more. They don't talk about her ever again. You somehow don't hear her coughing or anything.
I mean, nothing the gist happens of the movie that. Is that the Germans, the SS, are turning normal French peasants into murderous zombie whatevers, and yet this aunt, this person is living in this house and she's not attacking anybody. Are they giving her raw meat in order to placate her? I don't know. It made no sense.
It didn't make sense, and they didn't build on that at all. And they like alluded to oh, the Nazis found her and they killed the aunt for whatever reason. Halfway through, when it seems like things are going to start picking up, and they, like, show the main dude.
Yes.
And he's...
Are we going to get a zombie horde? Is there a zombie horde coming?
Not a fucking zombie horde, for one thing. But, like, you remember when he's there and he sees, like, the wall and it's got, like, the three rooms?
Yes.
And he, like, peeks in one and you catch, like, a glimpse of a body, and they do literally nothing else with that? That fucking pissed me off. There were so many wasted opportunities. And, like, the zombie dude that was there, that, like, lead Nazi, you know, he had, like, the blown-out face, and then it healed mostly, and then just stopped healing, and it looked like he had a chunk of raw meat on his face for the rest of the movie. It was just dumb. It was really a waste of time.
We should have gone to see the girl in the spider's web instead.
Even though I'm not sure about that one.
But at least that would have been a little bit better.
I mean, hopefully.
Maybe. I don't know.
You know, honestly, anything would have been better than that.
But I really don't. Not since Justice League has there been such a gross misrepresentation of a movie from its trailer to the actual movie that you see in the movie theater. And I know that there's reasons that happened for Justice League, because obviously what we saw in the trailer was what Zack Snyder's movie was going to be, and then he got himself fired from the movie, and then they brought in Joss Whedon,
and
Joss
he fucked, Whedon the fucked whole everything thing up.
Over,
yeah,
and just spooged all over the movie and made it horrible.
Yeah, but you're right, there was a reason for the trailer showing us a different movie,
because it was a different movie than
Justice League. Exactly. This, they just mismarketed it. They wanted you to think, oh, here's a World War II zombie horde movie.
I honestly thought it was going to be like Call of Duty Zombies. That would have been awesome.
Exactly.
If it had been Nazi Zombies, that would have been fucking awesome.
That was what I came in wanting to see. There is a movie called Frankenstein's Army. I've mentioned it to you before.
And I've been meaning to watch it.
It's super weird, and it's kind of low budget, and it's just kind of one of those campy cult movies. You know, I mean, that wasn't like a big mainstream movie or anything, mm-hmm. but honestly, I like that movie so much more than Overlord, unironically.
No, it was not good. It was not good at all.
I know. I get passionate about movies, so I'm willing to talk about this nonstop. We should have our own branch off, like a spin-off series of this podcast.
That's Do we need a second podcast?
Yeah, just us bitching about movies.
Oh, yeah.
Or giving rave reviews to movies. And I think
the problem is that I'm an amateur writer, you're an amateur writer and screenplay writer, and it's like, as bad as we are and as amateurish as we are, we could have written a better movie.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of other people could have too. I mean, you know.
Oh, I know. Because, I mean, if you look at that, it was supposed to be like, or it looked like it was supposed to be Nazi zombie movie. I mean, you and I could get together and rewrite Overlord and make it better.
Oh, yeah.
Make it for what sure. it looked like it was going to be.
For sure. Absolutely.
Ugh.
It was disgusting. I was disappointed. I'm glad that we didn't spend more money going to the movie, like buying popcorn and drink and shit like that.
Oh, I know.
That we just went and kind of just saw the movie and said, fuck it, we'll watch a movie. It wasn't that good.
No, it wasn't.
It sucked.
It really wasn't.
Anyway, Crimes of Grindelwald comes out this weekend. We need to go see that.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one, actually. That one, I hope it's good.
That looks really good. There is a underlying political statement going on in the Crimes of Grindelwald movies.
Because
Gellert Grindelwald, you know, he's organizing the wizarding world, purebloods only, wizards should be ruling over muggles. That's that nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
That we have problems with here in the United States that other countries have problems with in their own, you know, in their own right.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so I think it's a really good movie. A lot of people aren't going to realize that that's what's there, but hopefully they do it some justice.
And my hope is, even if you're like, you know, a kid getting into the Harry Potter universe, you can still go and watch this and be like, that was a cool Harry Potter universe movie. And, you know, you could go back and watch it later and be like, okay, I see that there's some political shit to it.
I see the political subtext. And I think that's J.K. Rowling realizing that she can make a statement in her movies and in her writing.
Yeah, because she knows people are going to pay attention. She could write literally anything she wanted to, and people are going to be like, ooh, J.K. Rowling? Oh, my God.
What is she? Well, she wrote, what is it? Something Vacancy? She wrote that one book under a pseudonym and then realized it was her. She wrote a book that was not set in the Harry Potter universe at all.
I have no idea what that is.
Anyway. Well, Dylan.
That's me.
What's your topic?
All right. So, I'm going to talk to you about the Black Monk House, or the Black Monk of Pontefract. Are you familiar with it?
No. I love it.
Okay. You know how intense Enfield is.
Yes.
This was a decade before Enfield happened, and even after Enfield, they refer to this as UK's most violent haunting.
I'm all over it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was real excited to hear about this. All right, so we're going to be focusing mainly on the Pritchard family. So you've got Joe Pritchard, the dad. You got Jean, the wife. Jean's mom, Sarah. Diane, the daughter. And Philip, the son. And they were tormented in this house for 5 years.
Motherfucker.
Go to our Instagram right now and you will see some really cool pictures, I hope. God, I hope you guys will dig it as much as we do.
You're scaring the shit out of me
right now. I'll get into that at the end of the story.
Got it.
Anyway, I will remind you of who these people are as we go on in the story, just so you can keep track of it. So this is set in 1966. This family, the Pritchards, moved in. What they didn't realize was that the house that was built, the ground that it was on, not an ancient Indian burial ground, because this is the UK, this was the same land that the town used to have their gallows on.
God damn it, that's even worse.
Yeah, this is a place where they just murdered the criminals of the town. So that's how you know it's a like good start. Like the
Spanish governor's mansion where they would hang people in the courtyard.
Exactly.
They had a hanging tree.
Oh yeah. Just going into it, there was the typical haunting shit. There was lights flickering on and off, switching around, random knocking, strange sounds throughout the house. There were objects moving. But then here's where the weirder parts of it go. They saw objects levitating pretty frequently.
Okay.
They were also stalked by a large black figure, and we'll get into that later on. And so much more.
So much more to come.
So much more to come. So, the Pritchards, they've had these experiences for a while in their house. And there are even, like, official police reports, again, where police experience this shit firsthand, but the townspeople didn't believe them, so they were the subject of mockery for a long time.
That's horrible.
Oh, I know. On top of all this terrible, terrible shit that's going on, they're getting mocked by their neighbors and the other townsfolk, like, for no reason. A bunch of assholes. Anyway, so back to, this is the first year, in August of 1966, they'd been moved in for a couple months. I don't remember exactly when they moved in. But in August, the family went on to a trip except for Philip, the son, and Sarah, the grandmother. They stayed home.
There's no way you get me to stay in this house by myself or that few people.
Oh, I know. And they're going to learn to regret it.
Got it.
So, the rest of the family was gone for a couple days. At one point during Philip and Sarah's time there, Philip left the house just to, you know, go to the store or go hang out with friends.
So the grandma's in the house by herself. Yeah,
grandma's in the house by herself. Philip is off with some friends. And upon Philip's return, he notices a white powder falling, like, in the house that's coming from nowhere. And it's in various areas of the house, but there's no apparent source. It's just, like, it's snowing. But it's like cocaine.
Okay.
But not as fun.
It's a coke house, but not so much fun.
Exactly. So there's this white powder falling from nowhere. They couldn't find the source. But, like, a couple days before the family, or the rest of the family left, they had the house cleaned and, like, things were moved around and polished and everything was clean and dusted. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't have just been, like, dust. There was no reason for this shit to be happening. They thought it was really weird. Philip and Sarah were both, like, this some bonkers shit. So they called Philip's aunt to come to the house because she lived close by. She came over to help, and after a little bit of time in the house, the powder seemed to stop, and there's like, you know, she couldn't figure out what was going on either. But after a little bit of time in the house, she slipped and fell in the kitchen.
Jeez.
And that's when she noticed various puddles in the kitchen, again, with no source. There was no leak in the house.
Okay.
There were just distinct puddles in different areas, like not where pipes were. It was just really weird. It was some sort of liquid. Who knows what kind?
Water, ectoplasm.
I'm going to go with ectoplasm because I like ectoplasm.
There you go.
But there was no noticeable leaks or origin for this ectoplasm. But anyway, as the day went on, they noticed more puddles of water in different areas, as well as more powder that looked kind of like sugar and leaves scattered throughout the house. Yeah, even though all the doors and windows were closed, it wasn't like, you know, it blew in, but it looked like sugar and leaves scattered throughout the house for no reason.
Okay.
There were sudden cold, like, drafts, cold spots in the houses. Certain appliances started turning on and off by themselves. All these things were amping up in intensity, and finally, Sarah, the grandmother, who was just horrified of what was going on, finally screamed stop. And at that point, that's when things stopped, but as soon as she finished her word, there was this horrible bang from the hallway behind them. They went to go investigate, and nobody was in the house. But there's this plant that was right near the staircase, and it had been thrown onto the floor off of its perch. They then heard another loud bang from the kitchen, so they did their little 180 and went back into the kitchen. When they were in there, they saw the china cabinet shaking violently, as if there was a little earthquake centered right under it. Okay. And as soon as the son, like, grabbed the cabinet and opened it up, it just stopped. There's no reason for it, but as soon as he interacted with it, just no more.
Jeez.
Another loud bang was heard. This continued throughout the day. Like, appliances on and off, weird cold spots, loud bangs, weird noises. During the night, it got a little more intense, and finally, Philip and Sarah said, fuck it, and they went to go sleep at their neighbor's house.
Yeah, so would I. Forever.
Yeah, no I'm kidding. I'm done. Yeah. Yeah, if I were the grandmother, I'd be like, no, that's okay. I'll go to a nursing
home. I live here now.
Yeah. So after a couple days of all this weird shit going on, the family returned and everything was peaceful. They didn't hear anything. The family thought, oh, it's just our son with an overactive imagination. You know, maybe grandma's not quite in her right mind. No need to really concern ourselves with it. So they blew him off. And this is where things start to get a little weird, because
This is when it starts getting weird.
Because for 2 years, nothing else happened. Not a fucking peep.
So it just goes dormant.
Just goes dormant for 2 years.
That's the worst.
And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the poltergeist returns. And now it's targeting their youngest child, Diane.
Of course it is.
Yes, it is. Remember, this is where I said things get weird, and this is where it earns its name as the most violent haunting.
Go ahead.
Diane, the youngest daughter, was repeatedly thrown from her bed, like picked up and thrown, or like yanked out of bed. She was shoved by the entity, pushed around, and at one point she was even dragged up the stairs by her throat.
Oh, God.
Yeah, which left visible lacerations and bruises on her neck.
Why do you stay?
Why do you stay? I wish I knew.
It's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. So it got real dark and real violent. So strange noises and objects moving and levitating, being thrown across rooms.
Still all that, happening.
Yeah, continued. Even in front of guests. Most poltergeists and stuff, you know, they have people over to investigate, or they have friends over, and things are calm. This poltergeist did not give a fuck. It just threw shit at guests, around guests. It was a big mess. The family brought in a priest to kind of bless and exorcise the house. During the exorcism of the house, objects started flying around rooms, being thrown violently off of shelves, and upside-down crosses appeared out of nothing on their walls.
Yeah. Say that again? That's horrible.
Upside down crosses.
Again, I'm gone.
Appearing out of nowhere while this priest is in there. Yeah, Annabelle's over there like peace deuces.
I'm gone.
Oh, yeah. So this made the entity incredibly upset, obviously. But while this priest was there, like I said, things are being thrown around. The crosses upside down are appearing. And this was a Christian family, so you know they have like some religious iconography around.
Mm-hmm.
Every single piece of religious iconography that they had was damaged in some way. And like aside from the other things being thrown, the rest of it was fine, but like any crosses they had were broken or, you know, thrown upside down, thrown onto the ground. Jesus figures were broken. Anything they had that was related to their Christianity was broken while this priest was there.
That's horrible.
Oh, yeah. A little while goes by of this still happening, and then we get into...
Phase three?
Into phase three.
Got it.
So Joe and Jean, the mom and dad, were the first ones to see the actual form of the entity.
Christ almighty.
Oh, they wish. They described it as a large, shadowy, cloaked figure. It looked like a big man in a black robe. You couldn't even make out any distinguishing human features other than just kind of the general outline of a person.
Right.
The first time they saw it, Joe and Jean were laying in bed.
No.
Asleep. It's the middle of the night.
God damn it.
And they wake up and they're paralyzed, and the black figure is hovering over them, watching them sleep.
Stop. I don't need to hear this.
Imagine a large man in a black robe.
I need to go to sleep tonight.
Hovering over you, watching you.
This is why we call our podcast Too Scared to Sleep.
Yeah, because Jake can never get a good night's sleep.
That's not true. I go home and I fall asleep so fast.
That's true. It's because you're old.
It's like, man, I'm really going to have a...
God. Like my dad.
Like a dad.
Shout out to my dad who listens to this. What a guy.
I know.
Anyway, so yeah, they saw it hovering over them, and it's just horrible. After that, there was a little bit more activity in the house, more of like the young daughter getting attacked. Nothing as violent as getting dragged up the stairs by her fucking throat.
Doesn't matter, it's still horrible.
Oh yeah, still horrible. And then again, it just stopped for like a year. And that's, like, everything that's going on is really, really weird and creepy, but the fact that it'll just stop for, like, a year or 2 years is horrifying because you think, oh my god,
because you never know when it's going to come back.
I know, like, if it's been 2 years, you're like, look at that, must be done, and then surprise, bitch.
I'm back. Surprise, motherfucker.
Exactly. So, it was dead dormant. It was dormant for about a year. Then a film came out called When the Lights Went Out. It was a British film, which was loosely based off of the stories that people had heard about the black monk in the house. And that pissed it off.
Oh my god.
That's when activity, yeah, that's when activity started again. There was a story of one of the neighbors that was there, and it was, or this was shortly after the movie came out, and she knew that the family didn't have a TV. She knew that the family was selling the house because they can finally do that so they can get out. And this neighbor saw the son out in the yard, and she was like, hey, have the people started moving in? Because last night, you know, I heard a TV really loud. Mm-hmm. Have the people started moving in? When are y'all going to go? And the son was like, there's not a TV in our house. Nobody's moving in yet. Okay. And then all of a sudden he just went pale and he said, oh god, it started again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so things are getting weird again. But they sold the house, they were able to get it away, and it was sold to the film's producer, Bill Bungay, the guy who made the movie on this house, who knows the stories.
The only guy who'd be willing to go into that fucking house.
I know, and he bought it. But it was sold again. He couldn't handle it. He was smart and sold it faster, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. While this film producer, Bill, was there, they did some research into the history of the house and, like, when it was a gallows beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that this is where the name the Black Monk comes from, because they were seeing the hooded figure. So they did some research into the history of the gallows and the property that was the area before the house was built. Okay. And they think that the Black Monk that you see there is potentially a 16th century monk who was accused of raping and killing a young girl. And he was hanged in the gallows that was where the property was at. So that's where the name the Black Monk comes from. That and the hooded figure that they see all the time while they're there.
Right, and he was attacking one of the daughters.
Yeah, and he was targeting the youngest daughter, being the most violent to her. Exactly. We mentioned at the beginning here that you should check out our Instagram. Now is the time to check it out, because there are two very well-known pictures of the Black Monk that are shown in the house. And both of them, here's the creepiest part, both of them are recent. They weren't in the 1960s when this was in its heyday. The people who bought the house after the film producer opened it up to do tours for it. So it's open to the public. You can go in and visit and check it out. They've only said that Ouija boards and exorcisms in the house are strictly forbidden because the exorcisms pissed it off the first time, and Ouija boards are just a bad idea no matter where you go, as I know.
We all know that.
Oh, yes, we do.
These pictures are horrible.
Yes, they are. The two pictures that are well known, one of them is taken from the top of a staircase down, and you can see the mirror. You see a figure with like a human-ish face in a big black cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to pull this up so Annabelle can see it.
I wish I had never looked at this photo. God, that's horrible.
Come here. Come here.
You have to see it. We have to get your reaction.
Come here.
Okay. So that's picture number one. As you can see, the person, there's the hood and the face, and that's the rest of the cloak. That's the mirror.
That's a grandma.
It's not a
grandma. It literally looks like a little old lady that's going to go shopping. Like, she's not trying to haunt.
But there's nobody there.
Okay, but then it's a grandma ghost, and everybody thinks she's a dark monk, but she just wants groceries and lemons.
Groceries and lemons? Okay, fine.
You have to admit, that one looks a little...
She also wants a carton of menthols.
It doesn't look menacing. Like, I'm not afraid of the grandma wearing the cloak. But I do see... how she's wearing just kind of something around her head, but grandmas get cold.
Okay, well, you may like this one a little bit better. This is the second picture, which shows an arm in black holding what appears to be rosary beads that are swinging. And again, nobody was there when they took the picture, but you can see that it's the arm, looks like it's got like a black sleeve, and they described it as rosary beads when they saw it, and they took the picture.
I see it right there. That's horrible. Yep.
I can see it, but I don't know. I can't be afraid of an arm.
You know what? I cannot wait until you go on a ghost tour.
Yeah, I probably would be the one to see a ghost. But God, this just looks like a little lady haunting a house.
The skeptic always
sees it. But I get how everyone's afraid because it did choke a girl out and drag her up.
Yeah, dragged her up the stairs by her throat.
No. Yeah, that's when I'm like...
You'd be scared of an arm then.
Yeah, I probably would. But just looking at a picture on Google...
Yeah. Okay, fine. Get your dumb reactions out of here.
Get your skeptical ass out of there.
Get your... God, so disappointing.
Get the fuck off our obstacle course, private pile.
Oh my God. Okay, so anyway, yeah. Those are the two big pictures. The one that Annabelle says is just a little old lady going for a pack of Reds in the mirror. And a black arm that she's not horrified of holding
filter shorts.
Rosary beads. Well, Annabelle killed my mojo, but that's the end of the story.
I know. Thanks a lot.
I'm sorry.
You know what? Our one listener will understand.
Yeah.
Arlene.
Not Arlene.
No, Arlene and Jamie F.
Jamie. Stop. We have to stop giving her shout-outs.
Why? Other people will know if they listen, then she gets the show.
She's going to send us a message saying, please stop talking about me every episode. You guys are weirding me out.
And then we're going to lose our one person that we can shout out other than Arlene.
Then it's just going to be...
And my dad. And then it's just weird.
Right.
So anyway, Jacob, I would like for you to tell me a story.
All right. Okay, so the last two episodes have been stories. They have been linked and connected. And this third topic is the final topic in this three-part series that involves... the FBI, the ATF, white supremacists, and such.
Oh, hell yeah. We're just hitting all the bases right now.
I'm going to talk to you today about the Oklahoma City bombing that happened in 1995. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, because neither of you were even born at that time, right? The Oklahoma City bombing was a domestic terrorist attack that happened on April 19th, 1995. A man named Timothy McVeigh drove a truck bomb up to the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building at 9 o'clock in the morning and set a fuse on the bomb and destroyed half of the building.
No shit.
He killed 168 people, including 19 children.
Damn.
He injured more than 680 people. The blast destroyed or damaged 324 other buildings within a 16-block radius, shattered glass in 258 nearby buildings, and destroyed or burned 86 cars, causing an estimated $652 million worth of damage.
Not bad for one guy.
Right. They felt it on the Richter scale.
No shit.
Which I will get to in due time. But the true story of the Oklahoma City bombing really is a story, like I said, about white supremacy, hate, anti-Semitism. It's got its roots in that nationalism, white nationalism, which is dangerous.
Yeah, it is. White people are the worst.
White people are the worst. Okay, so to start off with, I want to talk to you about a novel written in 1978 called The Turner Diaries. The Turner Diaries was written by a piece of shit named William Luther Pierce under the pseudonym of Andrew McDonald. And The Turner Diaries is a, it's like a graphic novel, sort of. It's got graphic novel components to it.
Is this like the Action Bible?
Kind of like the Action Bible.
Sweet Jesus.
It talks about a violent revolution in the United States that leads to the overthrow of the federal government, ultimately a nuclear war and a race war.
Okay.
Right. The way that the story is framed in the Turner Diaries, it's set in 2099 after all of these events have happened, and whoever is writing the story finds the diary of this man named Turner, something Turner, and he talks about how he was brought into this revolution. Ultimately, gays, Jews, non-whites are all exterminated, and only white people are surviving in 2099.
Okay.
In this newly formed, you know, anti-Semitic, white-only culture in the United States. The book has been described as explicitly racist and anti-Semitic. It has been labeled the Bible of the racist right by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. So, in the Turner Diaries, the story starts in 1999, after the federal government has confiscated all civilian firearms in the country, and then fictionally. So this man named Turner and his friends decide that they're going to create an underground organization, and they're going to wage a guerrilla war against the federal government, which they feel is dominated and is depicted as dominated by Jewish oligarchs. So they eventually, his guerrilla tactics and his guerrilla warfare actions, they are noticed by other members of white supremacist group. And he is initiated into a white supremacist group called the Order in the story. And the Order is a semi-religious inner cadre of elite masterminds who are trying to revolt. And they secretly, you know, they're able to overthrow the government, basically. But one of the things that's really noteworthy about the Turner Diaries is it depicts this man Turner as being able to gather materials to create a fertilizer bomb, mm-hmm. and he puts it into a moving truck, and he drives this moving truck into the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., and he destroys the FBI headquarters, causing casualties and property damage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've all been there.
Right, in the Turner Diaries. So that's what happens. Now, fast forward to 1983. People are reading this, white supremacists are reading this. A group of white supremacists led by a man named Robert Matthews decide that they're going to start a group called that they name the Order after the Turner Diaries Order.
It's like Scientology for racists.
Yes. And they decide that they're going to raise funds by committing armed robbery, and that they're going to make a kill list of people that they want to kill.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Right. So,
it's like people that are way too mm-hmm. into a fandom.
Exactly.
This is the white supremacist fandom.
They were already an anti-communist militia made up of survivalists and fundamentalist Mormons, but then they decide that they're going to turn to white supremacy. They robbed a sex shop. They did a couple of really lucrative bank robberies. They
of all bombed, the places to rob, why a sex shop?
I don't know, dude. I don't know. Later on, they bombed maybe it was a gay sex shop.
Maybe.
Because the only thing that racists hate more than minorities is gays.
That's true.
Because
that's
they're true. All secretly.
Because they're all gay.
Well, they're secretly hating on their own homoerotic whatever it is that they have going on in their heads.
Oh, cut yeah. that out. Never mind. No, not editing that out.
Don't cut it. To cut it out, please.
No.
All right, so.
What are we going to do? Offend the racists?
Right. So, first, after the sex shop, they move on to a couple of bank robberies, and then they ended up bombing a theater and a synagogue.
God damn it.
They also had a counterfeit operation, and they decided at one point, like I said, to draw up a hit list of people that they wanted to kill. And they found a liberal radio talk show host by the name of Alan Berg, who was also Jewish. And he would get on his radio talk show, and he would talk about he would have white supremacists on, and he would berate them, and he would try to present logic to their racist views and that sort of thing. And Robert Matthews murdered the radio DJ Alan Berg outside of his home.
Oh shit.
And he was assisted by other members of the order when he did this. So they committed an armored car robbery. Very, very brave. Out in the middle of the daytime, they commit this armored car robbery, and Robert Matthews ends up dropping his handgun during the robbery. And so they're able to run his prints, and they try to find him. They track him down on a house on this island in Washington State called Whidbey Island, and there is a standoff. Some of the members of the order get out of the house. They surrender. But Matthews is there. He's pinned down. He's exchanging fire with the FBI agents who are after him. Because every bank robbery of that kind is a federal offense.
Yeah.
And at one point during the night, the FBI agents are firing incendiary flares and tracer bullets.
Okay.
And groovy. The cabin where they're at, where Robert Matthews is at, goes up in flames, and he dies in the process.
All right, nice.
So white nationalists, white supremacists consider him a martyr because he died for those beliefs of his.
Less nice.
10 members of his group were tried and convicted for racketeering, 2 for their role in the 1984 murder of Alan Berg, as an aftermath. But something else that's very notable about this is that the FBI decides that they're going to turn their investigative eye towards white supremacists and militias all over the country, most especially in Washington State and Northern Idaho.
Okay.
So, this is why they're looking at white supremacists around 1992. In 1992, what we know is for episode 1 of my arc, is that's when Randy Weaver happened to be at a white supremacist rally, and an FBI informant or an FBI agent saw him and decided to try to make an inroad with him to try to get connected to some names within the Aryan Nation, because they wanted to know if these guys are stockpiling weapons, if they're planning any kind of terrorist activity, domestic terrorist activities. So, of course, Randy Weaver didn't play ball with the federal government. He ended up getting a warrant for his arrest because he missed a court date. They sent the federal marshals out there. The marshals got into a firefight with him. His son was killed the next day while Randy Weaver and his daughter and a friend of theirs are trying to go see the son in the shed. They're shot at again. And on that second day of the standoff, Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky Weaver, is shot in the head and killed in their cabin. The standoff lasts another 10 days before they finally surrender. And of course, this just kicks up all of that white supremacist hate and fear of the federal government. And it plays into their propaganda.
Yeah, because as much as I don't like white supremacists, the federal government really just fucked it all up.
Right. So, that happens in 1992, August of 1992. In April, keep in mind, April 19th, 1993, mm-hmm. is when the FBI and the ATF, after a 51-day siege of Waco, of the Branch Davidian compound, outside of Waco, drive their Bradley fighting vehicles into the building, and they're throwing tear gas in there, and somehow these fires start. And all of those people at the Branch Davidian compound, including David Koresh, their leader, are killed.
Yeah.
So again, all of that white supremacist fervor is just fed by these two events.
Fuel for the fire.
Yes. Which is really three events, because I never talked about the Turner Diaries until now.
Yeah, that's true. The Turner Diaries right. and these two actual events.
Right. But that's what's happening. Okay, so let's talk about the perpetrator of the Oklahoma City bombing and how he plays into it.
Yes, let's.
Timothy McVeigh was born in 1968. He grew up in upstate New York. His parents were divorced and he was raised by his father. Growing up, he was shy and withdrawn. He claimed he was bullied in high school. He was very close to his grandfather, who introduced him to firearms. And when he was a kid, he would tell people that he wanted to be a gun shop owner. And he became intensely interested in gun rights, as well as the Second Amendment. And after he graduated from high school, he read magazines like Soldier of Fortune and that sort of thing.
Okay.
After he graduated from high school, he joins the U.S. Army. He becomes a top-scoring gunner of the 25-millimeter cannon that's on top of a Bradley fighting vehicle.
Okay.
He was in the 1st Infantry, and he was eventually promoted to a sergeant in the United States Army.
Good for him.
Right. He was in Fort Riley, Kansas, before being deployed on to Operation Desert Storm. At one point in his Army career, he was reprimanded because he purchased and wore a white power T-shirt. He went to a Ku Klux Klan rally,
Fuck's sake.
Where they were protesting because they saw that black servicemen in the Army were wearing black power T-shirts on the military base. So he goes to a Ku Klux Klan rally and buys a white power T-shirt, and he's wearing that on base. And he gets reprimanded on that. Right? Okay. Timothy McVeigh ends up writing an autobiography at some point before he's gone. He talks about how he became disillusioned with the war once he was over there in Kuwait. One time he remembers the first time that he fired his rifle and decapitated an Iraqi soldier.
Jesus.
He talks about how he was shocked to be ordered to execute surrendering prisoners and also to see dead bodies on the side of the road when he was leaving Kuwait City. So he's kind of disillusioned by his time being deployed. He had always wanted to join the special forces in the Army. So once he gets back from his tour overseas, he enters the special selection program to be a Green Beret. It's a 21-day period. It's very rigorous. It's very demanding. And he ends up washing out on the second day.
Jesus. Right. Okay.
I mean, I don't even know what kind of process it is. I'm sure there's documentaries on it.
Oh,
but
I know.
He washes out. Very, very, very upset at himself. Very upset. Very disillusioned with the Army. So he leaves, and he's discharged from the Army in 1991. Now, he comes back to New York, upstate New York, and he has a very difficult time finding meaningful employment. Now, I remember when I was growing up, a couple of years after a friend of mine graduated from high school, we ran into her at Walmart here where we live, and she was working there. And she had gone into the military, and she had been in the Army for 4 years, and she'd come back. And I remember she expressed to my dad, who was with me, her disappointment in the fact that she did this and this and this, and she was a certain rank in the Army, and then she comes back, and the only job she can find is some bullshit job. So I get that.
Yeah.
Right. And Timothy McVeigh had much of the same, but of course he takes it in a totally different way. In 1993, and there's photos of him visiting the Waco Branch Davidian compound, where the roadblock was set up.
Mm-hmm.
He was there, and he was selling anti-government bumper stickers, some of them with swastikas on them.
Oh, wonderful.
He ends up finding work traveling with gun shows, and he used to hand out free cards printed with the name and address of Lou Horaci. Lou Horaci was the FBI sniper who was unofficially credited with killing Vicki Weaver.
Oh, shit.
He was handing out the name and the address of this guy.
Oh, damn.
He was hoping someone would assassinate
him. Oh, my God. What? Okay. Right. I mean, yeah, but...
So that's what he's doing. He also wrote hate mail to that man. McVeigh becomes a fixture on the gun show circuit. He starts traveling around. Now, if you don't know anything about gun shows, there are a lot of white supremacists who go to gun shows.
No surprise.
There are a lot of people who are going to feel the same way that he is. There's a lot of people who are going to be either directly connected, like in connected, or slightly associated with white supremacist movements all over the country. You're going to find people who are survivalists. You're going to find people who are, you know, say that they're part of a militia.
It's like Grindr for white supremacists.
It is like the Grindr for white supremacists. So he starts going around. He used to sell survival items, and he actually used to sell copies of the Turner Diaries. So at some point he decides, you know what? I'm past the information stage, and I want to get to the action stage of my revolution. So he connects with a friend of his, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier. They were friends of his in the army, and they all had an interest in survivalism, and they all kind of felt anti-government to one degree or another. But he decides that he wants to try to see what he can do with these guys. At one point, Timothy McVeigh lived in Arizona with Michael Fortier, and they were so close that Timothy McVeigh was his best man at his wedding.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Right.
So he's got a good buddy.
Mm-hmm. Now, April 19, 1993, McVeigh is actually in Michigan living with Terry Nichols, and he watched the Waco siege on TV, and he was there when the Branch Davidian compound went up in smoke. Terry Nichols and his brother started teaching McVeigh how to make explosives out of readily available materials, like household chemicals. And like I said, you know, he decided he wanted to try to take action. His anti-government rhetoric becomes more radical at this point. He started selling ATF hats riddled with bullet holes.
Oh, damn.
Okay. He started selling a gun, a flare gun, which he claimed could shoot down an ATF helicopter.
I think he's overhyping that one.
Right? He starts experimenting with pipe bombs and other explosives. Something that happens in November of 1993... here in the United States, is that this particular bill makes it through Congress and makes it through Senate and is signed by President Clinton, called the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, or the Brady Bill. Now,
the Brady Bunch.
Right, not that one. But what the Brady Bill does is that it mandates federal background checks on firearms purchasers, and it imposes a 5-day waiting period on these purchases. Okay. Now, it's named after the man named Brady. The Brady Bill is named after James Brady. James Brady was the White House press secretary under Ronald Reagan, and someone tried to assassinate Ronald Reagan in 1981. Brady was shot, and he became permanently disabled. He was in a wheelchair. He had problems slurring his speech, and they named the bill after him.
Okay.
Okay. So, according to the white supremacists, this puts restrictions on their Second Amendment rights. And so this just further fans those flames that they want to do something against the federal government.
Of course it does.
They're coming for our guns. Now, what are they going to do next? You know, that sort of thing.
They may even give minorities equal rights.
They might give minorities equal rights, yes. They might. Universal health care.
Oh my God.
What a bunch of assholes. Okay, so McVeigh decides at this point, around 1993, that he's going to start to travel around the country and try to find sites that he wants to bomb, or he wants to try to travel around to notable government sites where he feels like there's conspiracy theories happening or conspiracy moments. So he goes to Area 51. He takes photographs in Gulfport, Mississippi, because there was this idea that the United Nations was amassing an army there, and they were going to take over the country.
Hmm.
Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, in 1993, start to make bulk purchases of ammonium nitrate, which is a fertilizer that you can turn into a bomb.
You know, as you do.
Right. Exactly. You can turn it into a bomb. They started to stockpile it because there was a rumor that the federal government was going to ban it because everybody knew that you could do this. McVeigh told Michael Fortier about his plans to blow up a federal building, and Fortier declined to participate. He also told his wife about it. McVeigh says in his biography that he thought about assassinating Attorney General Janet Reno, who gave the order to move on the Branch Davidian compound, or Lou Hirachi. He thought about assassinating him. But after a while, he decided that he wanted to bomb a building because he felt like that sent a bigger message if you could bomb a building.
Yeah.
So he starts to try to find federal buildings that he wants to try to bomb. specifically ones where there's multiple branches of the federal government that he can hit at one time. The reason that he zeroed in on the federal building in Oklahoma City was because it was the regional offices of the Social Security Administration, Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Secret Service had an office there, the VA had an office there, the Department of Veterans Affairs. Yeah. They had Vocational Rehab Counseling Center there.
Okay.
The DEA had an office there. But more importantly, the ATF had an office there. And it was from there this Oklahoma City ATF office that those ATF agents had been the ones who were mobilized to Waco for the Branch Davidian standoff. And so that just, again, like I said, it solidified this is the place that he wants to go. What's the worst part about this, though, to me, is that even though it had about 550 employees there, they had dozens of other people who would be there during the day for whatever business that they needed to. Mm-hmm. But it also had a children's daycare center on the second floor.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
So, McVeigh starts to try to plan, and he starts to plan to construct a bomb. He's going to use more than 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. He is going to mix this with 1,200 pounds of liquid nitromethane.
That sounds fun.
Liquid nitromethane is race car fuel.
Oh, shit.
Yes. So this is going to intensify the bomb. I mean,
exponentially. It's going to fuck some shit up.
Yes, it's going to fuck some shit up. All in all, with the 55-gallon drums, the whole combined weight of this bomb is going to be about 7,000 pounds.
Damn.
Yes. He's going to put it into a truck. He's going to drive this truck up to the federal building. He's going to light the fuses, and he's going to run away. That's his plan.
So he's not even going to go down with the ship?
No.
Fucking coward.
Now, he was ready to go down with the ship if he needed to. He had a Glock 21, and he had it rigged that if he got stopped or was detained in any way, he could pull out his pistol, and he would be able to ignite the bomb remotely, because it's in the back. It's obviously in the cargo part.
Yeah.
He's going to rent. He ended up renting a Ryder truck. So on April 14th, 5 days before the bomb, he goes and pays for a motel room at the Dreamland Motel in Junction City, Kansas.
Okay.
The next day, he rents a Ryder truck, like I said, under the name of Robert Kling. And then from the 17th to the 18th, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols remove the bomb supplies from storage units in Harrington, Kansas, and load them into the Ryder truck. They then drove to a state park, and they nailed boards on the floor of the truck to hold 13 barrels in place, mixed the chemicals, the blasting caps, all that shit. They mixed it all up. So Terry Nichols is actually helping him.
Okay.
Terry Nichols decides he's got cold feet, doesn't want to do anything else. Once they're done in that state park, he drives home. Okay. So, April 19th, the morning of, Timothy McVeigh drives this Ryder truck up to the federal building. He's got pages from the Turner Diaries in an envelope with him when he does this.
Of course he does.
He does. Now, in the Turner Diaries, when Turner destroys the FBI building, he does it at 9 o'clock in the morning. So he's going to do it at 9 o'clock in the morning as well. He also was wearing a shirt that had a photo of President Abraham Lincoln with the motto Sic Semper Tyrannis, which means thus ever the tyrants.
Yeah.
Which we know from urban legend that John Wilkes Booth, there's a claim that when he shot President Lincoln in Ford Theater, that he jumped from the balcony and he yelled Sic Semper Tyrannis.
Yeah.
Before he ran off stage. So right before he gets to, right before Timothy McVeigh gets to the federal building, he stops for just a second and lights the fuses. And at 9:02 in the morning, his truck explodes on the front north side of the 9-story Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. 168 people were killed. More than half the building was destroyed in the explosion. There was a 30-foot-wide, 8-foot-deep crater.
Jesus.
The blast destroyed, 324 buildings within a 4-block radius. Shattered glass. It's horrible. The broken glass alone accounted for 5% of the death total and 69% of the injuries outside the building.
Wow.
The blast destroyed 86 cars.
So he accomplished the shit he wanted mm-hmm. to accomplish.
The effects of the blast were equivalent to over 5,000 pounds of TNT.
Damn.
it could be heard and felt up to 55 miles away. Told you that 4 miles away in Norman, Oklahoma. No, it was felt for it was felt as far away as Norman, Oklahoma, which is 4 miles away, and 16 miles away, they felt it as a 3.0 tremor on the Richter scale.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so if you go on Netflix right now, you can go. You can watch a PBS documentary, very good PBS documentary, about the Oklahoma City bombing. They talked to one federal worker who says he saw McVeigh walking away. Clean cut guy, tall, about 6 foot something, military style haircut. Thought, oh, here's a guy. He's coming to the federal building to pick up his orders, because every branch of the armed services had a recruiting station there in the building. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. They were all there too. So he saw him, but he saw him walking in the opposite direction. McVeigh tries to walk as calmly as he can for about 2 blocks, and then he books it, because obviously the blast is going to come. He only had about 2 minutes to get away. They talk about how, you know, they talk to people who were in the building. It was just horrible. Most of the deaths were caused by crush injuries. All the floors landed on each other. So they talk about how they talked to first responders who walked in, and when they were looking around, there were just these puddles of blood from in different spots. And it was where a person had been crushed. There were so many people that had been crushed to death. They talked to one surgeon. They pulled him straight from the hospital in Oklahoma City and said, "We've got a lady who's pinned, and we need you to amputate her leg in order to get her out."
Wow.
The worst part, of course, is they talked to a woman who worked in the building who lost 3 children in the daycare.
Oh, God.
They also talked to a dad whose 2 children were also in the daycare, and somehow they survived.
Oh, God.
He had a son and a daughter. The daughter only had cuts and bruises, and she had a broken collarbone. But their son suffered a brain injury because he had a piece of shrapnel that was embedded in his skull.
Oh, no.
It was horrible. So the FBI, of course, gets involved very quickly to try to figure out what's going on. They show news clips in the PBS documentary. The initial reports coming across the wires were maybe it has something to do with the Middle East. What you guys don't remember is that in 1993, there was a Middle East terrorist organization that tried to blow up the World Trade Center by planting a truck bomb.
Okay.
People were killed, but what they were trying to do is they were trying to topple building one into building two and bring both of them down.
Yeah.
They thought maybe it was a drug cartel trying to strike at the DEA, but they weren't quite sure. But here's the stupid fucking part. 90 minutes after the explosion, Timothy McVeigh is driving along I-35, and he is stopped by a Oklahoma highway patrolman because he's driving his getaway car and it doesn't have license plates on it.
What the fuck?
Yes. So the highway patrolman pulls him over, asks for his actual driver's license, notices that the car doesn't have driver's license plates, and notices that he has a bulge in the waist of his clothes, and asks him, "Son, do you have a gun?" And he says, "Yes." Well, his handgun license was not legal in Oklahoma, so he gets arrested and then put into county jail.
Okay.
So he's already caught, but they haven't linked him yet. So they start gathering information. They start trying to gather evidence from the explosion site. And their first break, the FBI's first break, comes when they find the axle of the Ryder truck that still has a VIN number. And it's really funny because, not really funny, but what's amazing is that they talk to one of the special agents in charge, and he says, "I'll never forget the number of the VIN.
Wow.
And he just recites it right off the top of his head.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine something like that having a big fucking impact.
Oh, yeah. So they find the VIN. They trace it to the Ryder truck in Junction City, Kansas. They go there, and they get a sketch of Timothy McVeigh. So he had used his fake ID, and he'd used his fake name of Robert Kling in order to secure the Ryder truck. But then they start to canvass the area trying to figure out where did the truck go after he rented it. And they end up at the Dreamland Motel. And it turns out that dumb piece of shit Timothy McVeigh wrote his real name on the hotel registry.
Of course he did.
Yes. And when they talk to the lady at the desk, she says, "Well, I think I threw him off because I asked him a question as he was writing his name, and just forgot." Right?
Yeah. All right.
FBI ended up conducting 28,000 interviews.
Wow.
They ended up collecting 3.5 tons of evidence and collected nearly 1 billion pieces of information. They had so many tips coming in over the hotline. But once they figured out, once they did the APB on Timothy McVeigh, they found out that he's in Oklahoma. He's still in Oklahoma, and he's in this little county jail, and he's about to be released.
Oh, shit.
On bail for his bullshit weapons charge.
Yeah.
And his driving without registration on a car. And they call down and they're like, "Hold him for just a second." And the federal agents come in and they meet with them and they sit down and they ask, "Well, do you know why we're here?" And he says, "Does it have something to do with the bombing?" So the guy didn't even try. He really didn't to get out of it. He knew what was going to happen. You know, in his mind, he's a martyr, I suppose.
Yeah.
He thinks
he's, he's probably like, they're here. They know what's up. You know, mm-hmm. No sense in hiding it. Yeah, I fucking did it.
He never wanted to get away with it. He really didn't.
Yeah. He probably wanted people to know, I'm the guy that did this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He was extremely proud of it. And he would always talk about, they try to, of course, try to see whether it was part of a larger conspiracy, if there were more people involved. And he said, "No, it was just me. And it was Terry Nichols and myself who did it." That's how easy it was to dismantle one federal building.
Wow, yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, think about it. Yeah, just two dudes, a truck, and a bunch of fertilizer.
Yeah.
And, you know, race car fuel.
When he went to trial, he tried a particular defense that had something to do with the fact that he was at war with the federal government, that they had basically declared war on the American people.
That sounds like some stupid shit.
Right, and it was like a justifiable retaliation, but of course it never went anywhere. So they were tried, and they were convicted in 1997. McVeigh received the death sentence, and he ended up being executed in 2001. Terry Nichols received life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Okay.
Michael Fortier was sentenced to 12 years. He testified against Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols and was only sentenced to 12 years.
Okay.
And he also worked out a plea deal for immunity for his wife.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to ask why he only got 12 years, but if he testified against him, then right. He didn't, you know, he wasn't the one that drove the truck, so like didn't have as big a part, I guess.
The reason that he was convicted was he failed to warn the United States government.
Okay.
But oh yeah, one of the other things that I say, we can always edit this in here, but one of the biggest things was once they figured out where Timothy McVeigh was and the Robert Kling thing, they were able to find out where that he had a fake ID, and they were able to go to the house. They were able to find the bomb making materials. They were able to find evidence. They found a burner phone that they had used multiple times in order to purchase the fertilizer and have it shipped to them.
Okay.
So that they could and purchase the other elements of the bomb to have it shipped to them so that they could build it.
So they used like one burner phone to order all the bomb parts?
Yeah.
That's again, dumb.
Again, it's basically helping the prosecution. Timothy McVeigh, like I said, was executed in 2001 after failing with some of his appeals. Mm. His last meal was 2 pints of mint chocolate chip ice cream.
Ugh. And not a fan of mint chocolate chip.
No, isn't that? That's the worst, right?
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, he is a white supremacist.
That is true. So he's already fucked in the head.
Yeah.
So that's my story. That's my three-part arc right there.
Oof.
All about how white nationalism and thinly veiled racism is one of the most dangerous threats to our society.
And how the federal government can not be the greatest.
Oh, yeah.
But even as stupid as they can be, they don't deserve to have what happened there happen. No. Nobody deserves to have their three kids die at their place of business.
Hundreds of people died. None of them had anything to do with what had happened at Ruby Ridge or at Waco.
Oh, I know. It's just, it's horrible. It's attacking a bunch of people that have nothing to do with what you're angry at just so that you can get more people angry at them.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous.
Hurt people. Hurt people.
God, this is Delilah.
This is Delilah.
Annabelle gave me an eat shit look.
I have the perfect song for this moment.
As Annabelle would say, it's something shitty from the
80s.
It's always something shitty from the 80s. It's always
something shitty. Delilah's emotionally stunted. She stopped growing in the 80s.
I don't even know what she looks like, but I bet it's terrible.
Oh, it's horrible. She looks like every grandmother.
Ugh. Man, so just in this episode, we have started and ended with people Annabelle hates.
That's right.
Man, this is a good one.
So I'm going to give you a sneak peek on what the next episode's going to be.
Ooh.
Are you ready for this?
I am ready.
Okay, so we are actually 1 week away from Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
We are. Thanksgiving Day is 1 week away from where we are right now.
Wow.
The next time we come to you, we will have already had our Thanksgiving break, our Thanksgiving holidays. But I am going with my family to Fort Collins, Colorado for Thanksgiving. Fort Collins is an hour away from Denver, an hour north of Denver, actually. But it is also an hour away from Estes Park, Colorado, where the famed and fabled and haunted Stanley Hotel is located.
I'm so excited for the Stanley.
Yes. So when I realized how close, just a couple of days ago, when I realized how close I was to the Stanley Hotel, I looked it up and it turns out they have a haunted tour and I already have my tickets and I am too ready to go on my haunted tour of the Stanley Hotel.
Too ready to sleep.
Yes. So next episode, my topic, just so you know, is going to be all about the historic Stanley Hotel and my experience at the Stanley Hotel.
And while you're there, you are taking pictures and you are getting video.
I'm allowed to take pictures.
And you are going to find the ghosts. I don't care how you do it. You're gonna get the ghosts to show up. Oh, you're gonna get a ghost in your picture.
I really don't need a ghost.
You're gonna get a ghost in your picture.
I'll try to see if I can feel something out, but I'm not looking forward to it.
Good. Oh, man. I would love to go to the Stanley.
It's beautiful. The photos of it are beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
So expensive to stay there, but it is so... It's only $28 to go on the haunted tour, so I had to.
Hell yeah.
I had to go.
Oh, yeah.
I had to. I booked it. And the booking, I mean, there's always it was sold out. There was like three tours every night, and I happened to get on the one that was still open.
Nice.
Which I was so excited about.
Yeah. Oh, and anti-exciting, but before I forget, we are actually not going to Jefferson and the Goatman's Bridge this year, or, you know, for New Year's. We just can't make the funds work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we are still going to do it, hopefully sometime before it gets ridiculously hot again. I'll talk about it then, but I just wanted to make sure, because like last episode, I think it was, I said, yeah, we're going to go, we're going to see the Goatman's Bridge, we're going to go
back to the future,
88 miles an hour, and we're not doing that, so I just want to let y'all know. But I'm excited to hear about... Fuck, my mic just fell on me. I'm excited to hear about your adventure at the Stanley. Anyway, I'm excited for you. And if you don't Snapchat me every minute that you're there.
Jesus Christ. Don't get so needy. Okay? I need you turning into a stage 5 clinger.
Jesus. Anyway, take pictures, take video, have fun, bring me back Colorado weed.
That's right.
Please.
No, I'm not going to do that either.
Please do.
You'll have to go and get your own.
Damn it. I can't afford to go to Colorado.
And I can't afford to buy you weed.
Damn it.
We're going on a budget, man.
All right, fine.
Crashing on people's couches. Anyway, all right. Well, from all of us here, we hope you have a happy Thanksgiving. Or, depending on when we release it, you've already had your happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. We hope everybody has fun. Not as much fun as Jake going to the Stanley. But, you know, we hope it's all right. Hopefully your in-laws didn't drive you crazy. Hopefully the food was good.
You son of a bitch.
What?
I already told you my mother-in-law's dead.
Okay, well, obviously I wasn't talking about you, you dick.
Don't worry about it. All right, guys. We hope you have a good night, and we hope that we have left you too scared to sleep.
Okay.
You're being so gross right now.
She's kissing the baby boy.
Don't look at its ass.
I didn't let him lick me. No.
Not yet.
Oh, but you have
He's going to expect you to let him go to second base.
He's a cute little baby. Look how sleepy he is.
Ugh, what an ugly dog.
No, don't you dare.
He's cute.
He's a beautiful baby.
He's just a sleepy boy.
That's funny. He's like, why did you let me down? I want to be on your lap.
Bless you. Oh, what a happy baby boy. Gorgeous.
Okay, back to it.
Shit.
I was like, don't break that. I gotta return it.
No.
Snap. If we can't have it, nobody can.
No, don't do that.
This is not the ASMR we signed up for. You've already stopped the podcast. You can talk.
How do I pause this?
Hey, I'm folk hungry.
I'm not hungry. Well, thank you for listening, and we hope you have... Oh, shit.
You motherfucker.
It's your fault.
Why? I can do it.
No, I'm gonna do it.
Fucker.